This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Fiasco, the American Military Adventure in Iraq by Thomas E. Ricks, read by James Lurie. Part 1. Containment. Chapter 1. A Bad Ending. Spring, 1991. President George W. Bush's decision to invade Iraq in 2003 ultimately may come to be seen as one of the most profligate actions in the history of American foreign policy. The consequences of his choice won't be clear for decades, but it already is abundantly apparent in mid-2006 that the U.S. government went to war in Iraq with scant solid international support and on the basis of incorrect information about weapons of mass destruction and a supposed nexus between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda's terrorism, and then occupied the country negligently. Thousands of U.S. troops and an untold number of Iraqis have died. Hundreds of billions of dollars have been spent, many of them squandered. Democracy may yet come to Iraq and the region, but so too may civil war or a regional conflagration, which in turn could lead to spiraling oil prices and a global economic shock. This audiobook subtitle terms the U.S. effort in Iraq an adventure in the critical sense of adventurism. That is, with the view that the U.S.-led invasion was launched recklessly, with a flawed plan for war and a worse approach to occupation. Spooked by its own false conclusions about the threat, the Bush administration hurried its diplomacy, short-circuited its war planning, and assembled an agonizingly incompetent occupation. None of this was inevitable. It was made possible only through the intellectual acrobatics of simultaneously worst-casing the threat presented by Iraq, while best-casing the subsequent cost and difficulty of occupying the country. How the U.S. government could launch a preemptive war based on false premises is the subject of the first relatively short part of this audiobook. Blame must lie foremost with President Bush himself, but his incompetence and arrogance are only part of the story. It takes more than one person to make a mess as big as Iraq. That is, Bush could only take such a careless action because of a series of systemic failures in the American system. Major lapses occurred within the National Security bureaucracy, from a weak National Security Council, NSC, to an overweening Pentagon and a confused intelligence apparatus. Larger failures of oversight also occurred in the political system, most notably in Congress, and in the inability of the media to find and present alternate sources of information about Iraq and the threat it did or didn't present to the United States. It is a tragedy in which every major player contributed to the errors, but in which the heroes tend to be anonymous and relatively powerless. The frontline American soldier doing his best in a difficult situation, the Iraqi civilian trying to care for a family amid chaos and violence. They are the people who pay every day with blood and tears for the failures of high officials and powerful institutions. The run-up to the war is particularly significant because it also laid the shaky foundation for the derelict occupation that followed, and that constitutes the major subject of Fiasco. While the Bush administration, and especially Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, and L. Paul Bremer III, bear much of the responsibility for the mishandling of the occupation in 2003 and early 2004, blame must also rest with the leadership of the U.S. military, who didn't prepare the U.S. Army for the challenge it faced, and then wasted a year by using counterproductive tactics that were employed in unprofessional ignorance of the basic tenets of counterinsurgency warfare. The seeds of the second President Bush's decision to invade were planted by the unfinished nature of the 1991 war, in which the U.S. military expelled Iraq from Kuwait, but ended the fighting prematurely and sloppily, without due consideration by the first President Bush and his advisors of what end state they wished to achieve. In February 1991, President Bush gave speeches that encouraged Iraqis to take matters into their own hands and force Saddam Hussein, the dictator, to step aside. U.S. Air Force aircraft dropped leaflets on fielded Iraqi units, urging them to rebel. On March 1st, Iraqi army units in Basra began to do just that. But when the Shiites of cities in the south rose up, U.S. forces stood by, their guns silent. It was Saddam Hussein who continued to fight. He didn't feel defeated, and in a sense really wasn't. Rather, in the face of the U.S. counterattack into Kuwait, Saddam simply had withdrawn from that front to launch fierce internal offenses against the Shiites in the south of Iraq in early March, and then, a few weeks later, against the Kurds in the north when they also rose up. An estimated 20,000 Shiites died in the aborted uprising. Tens of thousands of Kurds fled their homes and crossed into the mountains of Turkey, where they began to die of exposure. The most senior official in the first Bush administration, urging that more be done in the spring of 1991 to help the rebellious Shiites, was Paul Wolfowitz, then the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney, Joint Chiefs Chairman Colin Powell, and National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft disagreed, and so thousands of Shiites were killed as U.S. troops sat not many miles away. This is one reason that many neoconservatives would later view Powell not as the moral paragon many Americans do, but rather as someone willing to sit on his hands as Iraqis and later Bosnians were killed on his watch. Wolfowitz, for his part, penned an essay on the 1991 war 2 years later that listed the errors committed in its termination. With hindsight, it does seem like a mistake to have announced, even before the war was over, that we would not go to Baghdad, or to give Saddam the reassurance of the dignified ceasefire ceremony at Safwan, he wrote in 1993. Even at the time, it seemed unwise to allow Iraq to fly its helicopters, and all the more so to continue allowing them to do so when it became clear that their main objective was to slaughter Kurds in the north and Shia in the south. He pointed the finger at unnamed members of that Bush administration, some U.S. government officials at the time, who seemed to believe that a Shia-dominated Iraq would be an unacceptable outcome. And, he added, it was clearly a mistake not to have created a demilitarized zone in the south that would have been off-limits to Saddam's forces and maintained steady pressure on him. Finally, he cast some ominous aspersions on the motivations of unnamed senior U.S. military leaders, presumably Powell and Schwarzkopf. The failure to better protect the Kurds and the Shiites, he charged, in no small part reflected a miscalculation by some of our military commanders that a rapid disengagement was essential to preserve the luster of victory and to avoid getting stuck with post-war objectives that would prevent us from ever disengaging. Wolfowitz seemed at this point to be determined that if he ever again got the chance to deal with Iraq policy, he would not defer to such military judgments about the perceived need to avoid getting stuck in Iraq. A decade later, he would play a crucial role in the second Bush administration's drive to war, and I'll return repeatedly to examine his statements and actions. It is unusual for so much attention to be focused on a second-level official of sub-cabinet rank, but Wolfowitz was destined to play an unusually central role on Iraq policy. Andrew Bosevich, a Boston University foreign policy expert, is better placed than most to understand Wolfowitz, having first served a full career in the Army and then taught at Johns Hopkins University's School of International Affairs while Wolfowitz was its dean. More than any of the other dramatis personae in contemporary Washington, Wolfowitz embodies the central convictions to which the United States in the age of Bush subscribes, Bosevich wrote in 2005. He singled out, in particular, an extraordinary certainty in the righteousness of American actions married to an extraordinary confidence in the efficacy of American arms. There was one bright point for Wolfowitz in the muddled outcome of the 1991 war, the U.S.-led relief operation in northern Iraq. As it celebrated its swift triumph, the Bush administration grew increasingly embarrassed at seeing Saddam Hussein's relentless assault on the Kurds drive hordes of refugees into the snowy mountains along the Turkish-Iraqi border. The United States responded with a hastily improvised relief operation that gradually grew into a major effort, bringing tens of thousands of Kurds down from the mountains and at first feeding and sheltering them, and later bringing them home. Largely conducted out of public view, Operation Provide Comfort was historically significant in several ways. It was the U.S. military's first major humanitarian relief operation after the Cold War, and it brought home the point that with the Soviet rivalry gone, it would be far easier to use U.S. forces overseas, even in sensitive areas on or near former Eastern Bloc territory. It involved moving some Marine Corps forces hundreds of miles inland in the Mideast, far from their traditional coastal areas of operation, a precursor of the way the Marines would be used in Afghanistan a decade later. It employed unmanned aerial vehicles to gather intelligence. In another wave of the future for the U.S. military establishment, it was extremely joint, that is, involving the Army, Marine Corps, Air Force, Navy, Special Operations Troops, and Allied Forces. But most significantly, it was the first major long-term U.S. military operation on Iraqi soil. And in that way, it would come to provide Wolfowitz with a notion of how U.S. policy in Iraq might be redeemed after the messy end of the 1991 war. In retrospect, Provide Comfort also becomes striking because it brought together so many American military men who later would play a role in the U.S. occupation of Iraq in 2003. Provide Comfort began somewhat haphazardly, without clear strategic goals. It was initiated as an effort simply to keep Iraqi Kurds alive in the mountains, and so at first was seen just as a matter of airdropping supplies for about 10 days to stranded refugees. Next came a plan to build tent camps to house those people. But United Nations officials counseled strongly against setting up refugee camps in Turkey, for fear they would become like the Palestinian camps in Lebanon that never went away. So U.S. forces first tried to create a space back in Iraq where the refugees could go, and ultimately decided simply to push back the Iraqi military sufficiently to permit the Kurds to return to their homes. "And we carved out that area in the north," recalled Anthony Zinni, then a Marine Brigadier General who was Chief of Staff of Provide Comfort. "Once that last step had been taken," he said, "it became clear that we were saddling ourselves with an open-ended commitment to protect them in that environment." Wolfowitz flew out to northern Iraq to see the operation. "We were pushing the Iraqis real hard," then Army Lieutenant General Jay Garner, the commander of the operation, would recall. The leading edge of the U.S. push was a light infantry battalion commanded by an unusual Arabic-speaking lieutenant colonel named John Abizaid, who, in mid-2003, would become the commander of U.S. military operations in the Mideast. Abizaid was fighting what he would later call a dynamic war of maneuver. He was operating aggressively, but generally without shooting, to carve out a safe area for the Kurds by moving around Iraqi army outposts. He also had the advantage of having U.S. Air Force warplanes circling overhead, ready to attack. Wary of having American troops behind them, with routes of retreat cut off by the planes overhead, the Iraqi forces would then fall back and yield control of territory. "We moved our ground and air forces around the Iraqis in such a way that they could fight or leave, and they left," Abizaid said later. Zinni recalled that Wolfowitz was interested in seeing how this nervy mission was being conducted. With Garner, the two met briefly at an airfield built for Saddam Hussein at Sirsenkh, in far northern Iraq. "How was the U.S. military operating?" Wolfowitz asked. "Well," Zinni explained, "this Lieutenant Colonel Abizaid is pushing out the Iraqi forces, and we've got more and more space here inside Iraq for the Kurds, and we've kind of created a security zone or enclave of some 3,600 square miles. I started giving the brief, and he really, really got into it," recalled Zinni. "This was capturing him in some way. This was turning some lights on in his head. He was very interested in it. He was very excited about what we were doing there in a way that I didn't quite understand." That meeting in Sirsenkh would be one of the few times that Zinni and Wolfowitz would meet. but over the next 14 years the two men would become the yin and yang of American policy on Iraq, with one working near the top of the U.S. military establishment, while the other would be a sharp critic of the policy the first was implementing. Wolfowitz departed the Pentagon not long after his review of Provide Comfort, when the first Bush administration left office, and returned to academia. Zinni went fairly quickly from being chief of staff in northern Iraq to deputy commander at Central Command, and then to the top job in that headquarters, overseeing U.S. military operations in Iraq and the surrounding region from the Horn of Africa to Central Asia. In his command, his main task was overseeing the containment of Iraq. In that capacity, he would be kind of a groundbreaker for Marine Four stars, showing that a Marine could handle the job of being a SINC, Commander-in-Chief, or Regional Military Commander, an Air Force general recalled. Other Marines had held those top slots, but until Zinni, none had really distinguished himself in handling strategic issues. Wolfowitz, by contrast, spent the 1990s in opposition. His path intertwined briefly with Zinni's in the 2000 presidential election campaign, when both endorsed the Bush-Cheney ticket, though for very different reasons. After a year, Zinni would go into opposition against the Bush administration's drive toward war with Iraq, while Wolfowitz would become one of the architects of that war. They are very different men. Zinni is a Marine's Marine, who still speaks in the accents of working-class Philadelphia, while Wolfowitz is a soft-spoken Ivy League political scientist, the son of an Ivy League mathematician. Yet both men are bright and articulate and utterly sincere. Retired Colonel Gary Anderson, who knew Zinni and the Marines and later consulted with Wolfowitz on Iraq policy, said it was this very similarity between the two men that so divided them. "They both believe in their bones what they are saying," he observed. "Neither one is in any way disingenuous." Wolfowitz would say that realists, such as Zinni, did not understand that their policies were prodding the Mideast toward terrorism. "If you liked 9/11," he would say after that event, "just keep up policies such as the containment of Iraq." Zinni, for his part, would come to view Wolfowitz as a dangerous idealist who knew little about Iraq and had spent no real time on the ground there. Zinni would warn that Wolfowitz's advocacy of toppling Saddam Hussein through supporting Iraqi rebels was a dangerous and naive approach whose consequences hadn't been adequately considered. Largely unnoticed by most Americans during the 1990s, these contrasting views amounted to a prototype of the debate that would later occur over the 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq. Chapter 2: Containment and Its Discontents, 1992 to 2001. For over a decade after the 1991 war, it was the policy associated with General Zinni that prevailed, even through the first year of the presidency of George W. Bush. The aim of the U.S. government, generally in its words and certainly in its actions, was containment of Iraq, ringing Saddam Hussein with military forces, building up ground facilities in Kuwait, running intelligence operations in Kurdish areas, flying warplanes over much of his territory, and periodically pummeling Iraqi military and intelligence facilities with missiles and bombs. The Saddam Must Go school, associated with Paul Wolfowitz, was a dissident minority voice, generally disdained by those holding power in the U.S. government. Looking back at the containment policy, Zinni said, "We were piecemealing things without the coherence of a strategy. I'm not saying that the piecemealing things when it came about weren't necessary or didn't make sense, but they needed to be reviewed, and we needed some sort of strategic context back here to put them all inside of." It was a problem he would try to address when he became Chief of Central Command in 1997. But overall, he thought, the policy worked. "We contained Saddam," he said. "We watched his military shrink to less than half its size from the beginning of the Gulf War until the time I left command. Not only shrinking in size, but dealing with obsolete equipment, ill-trained troops, dissatisfaction in the ranks, a lot of absenteeism. We didn't see the Iraqis as a formidable force. We saw them as a decaying force." One day in 1996, Paul Wolfowitz toured Gettysburg with a group of specialists in military strategy from Johns Hopkins University's School of International Studies, where he became dean after his service under Cheney at the Pentagon. Late in the afternoon, as the sun dipped toward Seminary Ridge, Wolfowitz stood at the center of the battlefield, near the spot where the soldiers of Pickett's charge had hit the Federal line and were thrown back by point-blank cannon blasts. Pointedly, Elliot Cohen, the Johns Hopkins professor running the tour, had Wolfowitz read aloud to the group the angry telegram that President Lincoln had drafted, but never sent, to the new commander of the Army of the Potomac, General George Meade. "Why," Lincoln wanted to ask his general, "do you stop and not pursue your enemy when you have him on the run?" Wolfowitz came to believe that the policy of containment was profoundly immoral, like standing by and trying to contain Hitler's Germany. It was a comparison to which he would often return. It carried particular weight coming from him, as he had lost most of his Polish extended family in the Holocaust. His line survived because his father had left Poland in 1920. He talked about the Holocaust more in terms of policy than of personal history, most notably in giving him a profound wariness of policies of containment. He told the New York Times' Eric Schmidt that that sense of what happened in Europe in World War II has shaped a lot of my views. What if the West had tried to contain Hitler? This orientation toward Nazism would prove central to his thinking on Iraq. Again and again, he would describe Saddam Hussein and his security forces as the modern equivalent of the Gestapo. It was almost a verbal tic with him. Some observers of Wolfowitz speculate that another lesson he took from the Holocaust is that the American people need to be pushed to do the right thing, because by the time the United States entered World War II, it had been too late for millions of Jews and other victims of the Nazis. Asked about this in an interview before the war, Wolfowitz agreed and expanded on the thought, and himself linked it to Iraq. "I think the world in general has a tendency to say, if somebody evil like Saddam is killing his own people, that's too bad, but that's really not my business." "That's dangerous," he continued, "because Hussein was in a class with very few others. Stalin, Hitler, Kim Jong-il, people of that order of evil tend not to keep evil at home. They tend to export it in various ways, and eventually it bites us." After teaching political science at Yale, Wolfowitz as a diplomat helped bring democracy to South Korea and the Philippines in the 1970s and 80s. He took away from those experiences a belief that every country is capable of becoming democratic, and that their becoming so aids the American cause. "I think democracy is a universal idea," he would say, "and I think letting people rule themselves happens to be something that serves Americans and America's interests." Wolfowitz's bookish background also gave him an academic manner that can be disarming. There is in Wolfowitz little of the blustery Princeton frat boy towel-snapping banter on which Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld seems to thrive. His soft voice and mild manner frequently surprise those who have braced themselves for the encounter. "I actually was surprised to find, the first time I met him, that he was pretty likable, which surprised me because I hate him," said Paul Arcangeli, who served as an army officer in Iraq before being medically retired. "His loathing," he explained, "is a policy matter. I blame him for all this shit in Iraq. Even more than Rumsfeld, I blame him." His bottom line on Wolfowitz? Dangerously idealistic and crack-smoking stupid. But Wolfowitz's low-key manner cloaked a tough-minded determination that ran far deeper than is common in compromise-minded Washington. "One of the most important lessons of the Cold War," he wrote in the spring of 2000, "was demonstrating that your friends will be protected and taken care of, that your enemies will be punished, and that those who refuse to support you will live to regret having done so." In January 1998, the Project for the New American Century, an advocacy group for an interventionist Republican foreign policy, issued a letter urging President Clinton to take regime change in Iraq seriously. Among the 18 signers of the letter were Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Armitage, future UN Ambassador John Bolton, and several others who would move back into government 3 years later. The policy of containment of Saddam Hussein has been steadily eroding over the past several months, they wrote. Diplomacy is clearly failing, and removing Saddam Hussein and his regime from power needs to become the aim of American foreign policy. The alternative, they concluded, would be a course of weakness and drift. Containment was a very costly strategy, Wolfowitz said years later. It cost us billions of dollars. Estimates are around $30 billion. It cost us American lives. We lost American lives in Khobar Towers, a huge 1996 bombing in Saudi Arabia that killed 19 service members and wounded 372 others. But he also saw other costs. In some ways, the real price is much higher than that. The real price was giving Osama bin Laden his principal talking point. If you go back and read his notorious fatwa from 1998, where he called for the first time for killing Americans, his big complaint is that we have American troops on the holy soil of Saudi Arabia and that we're bombing Iraq. That was his big recruiting device, his big claim against us. Wolfowitz also saw another cost, one that most Americans hadn't noticed much. Finally, containment did nothing for the Iraqi people. Large parts of the Iraqi population suffered hugely under a contained Saddam, and the marsh Arabs of southern Iraq were on the route to being wiped out, he noted. That's what containment did for them. For those people, liberation came barely in time. Zinni, too, was growing uncomfortable with the price containment was inflicting on the Iraqi people. But from his perspective, the solution was to refine what was being done, not topple Saddam. He thought that international sanctions could be narrowed to focus more on keeping weapons, components, and other militarily useful items out of Iraq, while dropping economic sanctions that imposed unnecessary suffering on Iraqis. This was a theme that his old friend Colin Powell would take up a few years later, in 2001, when he became Secretary of State under President George W. Bush. But Zinni recalled that he didn't get much of a response in his attempts to interest Clinton administration officials in refining the containment strategy. As he made the rounds of Middle Eastern capitals, Zinni found himself crossing paths with Dick Cheney, then an ex-defense secretary who was CEO of Halliburton, the oil services and logistics company that did much business in that part of the world. "I'd be traveling around out there and I'd run into him all the time," he said. At Halliburton, he was always going into the tent to see the emir or the king. The two men weren't close, but Zinni felt he had a good enough sense of Cheney to know that he was a realist in terms of what happens on the ground, how to get things done. Very much someone who wanted to work through the United Nations and through building coalitions. Masterful at it. The climax of Zinni's time as commander in the Mideast was the four-day-long Desert Fox bombing campaign. There had been military moments in 1994 and 1996, but the 1998 raids would be the biggest U.S. military strikes in Iraq since the end of the 1991 war. This turned out to be the most intense enforcement of the containment policy that occurred in the entire 12-year period between the 1991 war and the 2003 invasion. Launched in reaction to a standoff with Saddam Hussein over weapons inspections, the attacks began on December 16, 1998, with a volley of over 200 cruise missiles from Navy ships and Air Force B-52 bombers. The next day, another 100 cruise missiles were fired. On the third night of airstrikes, B-1 swing-wing supersonic bombers made their first-ever appearance in combat. After a fourth night, the raids ended. A total of 415 cruise missiles had been used, more than the 317 employed during the entire 1991 Gulf War. They and 600 bombs hit a total of 97 sites, the major ones being facilities for the production and storage of chemical weapons and those associated with missiles that could deliver such munitions. In part, because U.S. intelligence was able to locate only a limited number of sites associated with weaponry, the strikes also hit government command and control facilities, such as intelligence and secret police headquarters. Some congressional Republicans were deeply suspicious of President Clinton and suggested that the strikes were simply a ploy to undercut the impending impeachment proceedings against him. Yet the raids proved surprisingly effective. "Desert Fox actually exceeded expectations," wrote Kenneth Pollack in The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq, his influential 2002 book. Saddam panicked during the strikes. Fearing that his control was threatened, he ordered large-scale arrests and executions, which backfired and destabilized his regime for months afterward. Zinni was amazed when Western intelligence assets in Baghdad reported that Desert Fox nearly knocked off Saddam Hussein's regime. His conclusion? Containment is clearly working, and Saddam Hussein was on the ropes. A U.S. military intelligence official, looking back at Desert Fox years later, confirmed that account. Arab allies of the United States were hearing the same reports, and that led them to go to General Zinni with an urgent question. If you do indeed topple Saddam Hussein, what will come next? This is what I heard from our Arab friends out there. You almost caused an implosion, Zinni recalled, and that worried them. An implosion is going to cause chaos. You're going to have to go in after an implosion. The question was, do you guys have a plan? The Arab leaders especially wanted to know what was going to be done to stem the possibility of a massive exodus of refugees into their countries, along with major economic dislocations. Also, they wanted to know, if Iraq disintegrates, what is going to be the Arab world's bulwark against the age-old threat of Iran? You tip this guy over, you could create a bigger problem for us than we have now, Arab officials said to Zinni. So what are you going to do about it? Zinni realized that he didn't have good answers to those questions. So, in June 1999, he had Booz Allen, the consulting firm, hold a classified war game on what such an aftermath might look like, what problems it would present, and how the U.S. government might respond. He asked that representatives not just of the military, but of the State Department and the Agency for International Development also participate. It brought out all the problems that have surfaced now, he said later. It shocked the hell out of me. In the wake of the war game, Zinni ordered Central Command to begin planning in case humanitarian relief operations in Iraq became necessary. But he wasn't able to interest other parts of the government in participating in that preparatory work. Back in the United States, Desert Fox looked different to some. At the time, it was fashionable to dismiss the operations as more avoidance by the Clinton administration, simply throwing cruise missiles at a problem that required more than that. David Kaye, a more sober observer, also was skeptical at the time about the effects of Desert Fox. It was only years later, after his Iraqi survey group, the U.S. government's post-war effort to find Iraq's supposed stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction, had interviewed and interrogated 200 officials from Iraqi weapons programs, that he realized that the four-day campaign had indeed had a devastating effect, far more than had been appreciated back in Washington. His post-invasion survey found, to his surprise, that after 1998, the Iraqi weapons programs, with the exception of missile building, withered away and never got momentum again. In a series of in-depth post-war interrogations, a score of veterans of Iraqi weapons programs told Kaye's group that the Desert Fox raids had left Iraqi weaponeers demoralized and despairing. They realized that they'd never be able to reestablish the type of industrial facility they were aiming at, he said in an interview. They'd spent years, lots of money and lots of energy on it, years and years, and they realized that as long as Saddam was in power, they'd never be able to reestablish production. In short, they'd given up. The other point that Desert Fox made to Iraqis was that visible elements of weaponry, such as missile programs, which require a large, easily observed infrastructure such as engine test stands, could be hammered at any time. Kaye added that he was taken aback to hear their accounts. For me, it was a bit of an eye-opener, because I'd always denigrated Desert Fox. What I failed to understand was that it was cumulative, coming on top of 8 years of sanctions. More than the physical damage, it was the devastating psychological effect that had really counted. And that was what U.S. intelligence assessments had missed in examining Iraq during the run-up to the war, he decided. But there also was an unexpected disadvantage to the success of Desert Fox. As Saddam reacted by tightening his internal controls, Iraqis inside the country in contact with U.S. intelligence grew far more wary. The Senate Intelligence Committee, in a 2004 autopsy of the intelligence failures made in handling Iraq, would report that after the raids, the U.S. intelligence community did not have a single human intelligence source, collecting against Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs. A catastrophic side effect of this new lack of information was that it led to a data vacuum in which the basis for the United States going to war 5 years later would be created. All sorts of wild claims could be made about Saddam's armaments programs in 2002 that later would be proven wrong, but at the time couldn't be refuted. Zinni's conclusion was that U.S. policy on Iraq succeeded in the late 90s. Containment worked. Look at Saddam. What did he have? Zinni asked later. He didn't threaten anyone in the region. He was contained. It was a pain in the ass, but he was contained. He had a deteriorated military. He wasn't a threat to the region. And what's more, he said, it wasn't a particularly costly effort. We contained day to day with fewer troops than go to work every day at the Pentagon. It was sometimes messy and it could have been done better, especially if sanctions had been dropped. But it had worked. Even before Desert Fox, Wolfowitz and Zinni clashed publicly over an issue of arming Iraqi rebels to try to overthrow Saddam. At a congressional hearing, Zinni pointedly dismissed that as a Bay of Goats approach destined to fail, as the CIA-sponsored Bay of Pigs attack on Castro had in 1961. I think a weakened, fragmented, chaotic Iraq, which could happen if this isn't done carefully, is more dangerous in the long run than a contained Saddam is now, he told a group of defense reporters in October 1998. I don't think these questions have been thought through or answered. He also took direct aim at the Iraqi exiles. I don't see that there is a viable opposition. Arming them, he said, would likely be a waste of money. Wolfowitz took a pop at Zinni in his published critique of the Clinton administration's Iraq policy. Toppling Saddam is the only outcome that can satisfy the vital U.S. interest in a stable and secure Gulf region, he wrote in the New Republic magazine in December 1998. The administration has continued to display paralyzing ambivalence. Marine General Anthony Zinni, commander of U.S. Gulf Forces, was even authorized to express the view that a weak, fragmented, chaotic Iraq would be more dangerous than Saddam's continuation in power, and to complain that the opposition isn't viable. Wolfowitz saw such realism as both immoral and wrongheaded. In 1999, he wrote that the United States should be prepared to commit ground forces to protect a sanctuary in southern Iraq where the opposition could safely mobilize. Zinni made it clear that he believed Wolfowitz and his ally Ahmed Chalabi, the Iraqi exile leader who later would become a Pentagon favorite, were dangerous naives who knew little about the reality of war. This is where they jumped on Chalabi's idea. Create an enclave, give me some special forces and air support, and I'll go in and topple the guy over, Zinni remembered. And I said, this is ridiculous, won't happen. This is going to generate another one of our defeats there where we get a bunch of people slaughtered. As a senior U.S. commander, Zinni also was offended by their presumption. A retired Special Operations General, Wayne Downing, was up there scheming with Danny Pletka and her husband. Pletka, then an aide to Senator Jesse Helms, was married to another congressional staffer. They had this scheme for arming Chalabi. It upset me, 'cause I'm the sink. These are my forces. I got staffers in Congress and retired generals working war plans. In addition to the potential for a small anti-Saddam force being massacred, he worried that their plan could wind up dragging the United States into war. The second issue is, they lead us into a mess. They piecemeal us into a fight, he said. Okay, it's special forces, it's small units, create an enclave, it's air support. But what do they then drag us into? Neither Iraq nor terrorism were issues in the 2000 presidential campaign, and in fact were hardly mentioned by the candidates of either party. Everything George W. Bush and Dick Cheney said during the campaign indicated that they thought Bill Clinton had used the military too much in his foreign policy, not too little. They outlined a stance of maintaining the policy of containment while being more selective about the use of force. Bush also argued against using the military in non-combat missions, hitting the issue hard in both debates of the presidential candidates. He believes in nation building, Bush said of Democratic candidate Al Gore at their first debate on October 3, 2000. I would be very careful about using our troops as nation builders. I believe the role of the military is to fight and win war, and therefore prevent war from happening in the first place. As a result of wanton Clinton administration policies, he added, I believe we're overextended in too many places. Bush emphasized this admonition at the next debate. I don't think our troops ought to be used for what's called nation-building, he said on October 11th. I think our troops ought to be used to fight and win war. I think our troops ought to be used to help overthrow a dictator when it's in our best interests. During the campaign, Vice Presidential candidate Cheney also defended the decision during the 1991 war to not attack Baghdad. The United States, he said during an interview on NBC's Meet the Press, should not act as though we were an imperialist power, willy-nilly moving into capitals in that part of the world, taking down governments. Cheney appeared to endorse the Clinton administration's containment policy, saying that we want to maintain our current posture vis-a-vis Iraq. After just a month in office, the Bush administration launched airstrikes against five sites in the Iraqi anti-aircraft network, three big radar systems, and two command and control facilities. The attacks were neither well-managed nor particularly successful. The U.S. military deemed the February 2001 strikes essential because the Iraqis were installing a fiber-optic communications network in their air defense system that would have greatly increased the threat to U.S. pilots operating in the southern no-fly zone. Anti-aircraft batteries in southern Iraq once had used their own radars to track U.S. and British jets, but radar-seeking missiles launched against those systems had proven so lethal that Iraqi troops had turned them off. Instead, the Iraqis were taking the innovative step of using powerful radars near Baghdad and outside the no-fly zone to track aircraft, and then planned to transmit the targeting data to the missile batteries in the south. Chinese workers were installing the network that would link up this new system. The raid had the odd and unexpected side effect of focusing the new administration less on Iraq and more on China. We're concerned about the apparent involvement of the Chinese with fiber optics in the Iraqi system, Condoleezza Rice said. Under the sanctions regime, there appears to be a problem. Iraq was almost an afterthought in that conference, with Bush saying he would conduct a review of Iraq policy in order to make the sanctions work. Indeed, that was the task that Powell took on during his first tour of the Mideast as Secretary of State. Containment and sanctions, he said, have worked, and Saddam Hussein wasn't a threat. Wolfowitz didn't agree with the policy, but he was in a minority even inside the Bush administration. As Powell traveled, Wolfowitz appeared before the Senate Armed Services Committee, which was weighing his nomination to be Rumsfeld's deputy. Wolfowitz candidly said that he favored toppling Saddam Hussein. I think there's no question that the whole region would be a safer place. Iraq would be a much more successful country, and the American national interest would benefit greatly if there were a change in regime in Iraq, he testified. If there's a real option to do that, I would certainly think it's still worthwhile. There really wasn't a war party inside the Bush administration before 9/11, said Patrick Clausen, a Middle East expert who moved in Washington's neoconservative circles. Rather, he said, there really was just Wolfowitz pleading for more attention to Iraq, and Wolfowitz's former Pentagon aide, I. Lewis Scooter Libby, Cheney's chief of staff in the new administration, listening supportively. Clausen dismissed the allegation made later by former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and others that the Bush administration came into office determined to invade Iraq. What O'Neill doesn't notice is that those who wanted to go to war lost, and those who supported smart sanctions won, he said. In the spring of 2001, he added, Rice, the new president's national security advisor, made it extremely clear to colleagues that they weren't going to do anything in Iraq. Wolfowitz and his few allies, mainly Libby and a few others in the office of the new vice president, traditionally not a powerful political base from which to operate, were stymied by Powell. Indeed, in the summer of 2001, it looked like Powell was winning the internal arguments that would shape the foreign policy of the new and inexperienced president. Powell's influence had been steadily growing, the New York Times' Bill Keller wrote later that year. Powell had negotiated a successful end to the confrontation with the Chinese, smoothed relations with Russia, and gotten the president engaged on Mideast peace negotiations. In all of this, the president was following the instincts of his Secretary of State, Keller wrote. The Washington Post's Jim Hoagland, one of the most hawkish columnists on Iraq, captured the unhappiness of those who wanted a more aggressive stance on Iraq. The new administration's open-minded review of Iraq policy, he warned, risks becoming a way of letting the mistakes of Bush 41 become the mistakes of Bush 43. Hoagland returned to the subject of the Iraq policy review in the summer of 2001, warning, by September, Bush needs to show that he knows where he is going on Iraq and the Middle East, and that he knows how he intends to get there. Chapter 3. This changes everything. The aftermath of 9/11. On the bright blue morning of September 11, 2001, Colonel Paul Hughes was in his office in the Pentagon's D-ring in Army staff space. It was 9:37 a.m. when the room exploded. Plaques and a clock shot off the walls. The bookshelves pitched forward. Hughes looked out the window and saw, above the Pentagon's roof, a huge fireball. "I am going to die today," he thought. He looked around and wondered why everyone and everything was silent, not realizing that the explosion of American Airlines Flight 77 hitting underneath his office at 530 miles per hour had temporarily robbed him of much of his hearing. He and his co-workers made their way through the acrid smoke to the Pentagon's courtyard, a football field of space with a hot dog stand in the middle. Security officers announced that a fourth plane was heading toward Washington, so the crowd moved out to the Pentagon's sprawling south parking lot. After waiting a while, he realized that it would be a long time before he got back into his office. So, without briefcase or Army beret, he walked the 4 miles to his sister's house in Alexandria. As he did, he dwelled on another American defeat. "I thought to myself, this is what a Union officer must have felt like in July of 1861, walking back from Bull Run, the first big battle of the Civil War, which ended with federal troops streaming back 25 miles to Washington. His bottom line on the day? We got our ass kicked." So began a path that 2 years later would have Colonel Hughes working on the strategy of the U.S. occupation in Iraq and then moving into opposition to U.S. policy there. The explosion at the Pentagon of Flight 77 and the day's 3 other hijack attacks provided the political opening that Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, and others needed. Perle and Wolfowitz quickly began to make the case that 9/11 was precipitated by a myopic and false realism that wrongly had sought accommodation with evil. The idea that we could live with another 20 years of stagnation in the Middle East that breeds this radicalism and breeds terrorism is, I think, just unacceptable, especially after September 11th, Wolfowitz later told the Jerusalem Post. In a talk in New York, he added, "We cannot go back to business as usual. We cannot think that this problem of Islamic extremist-based terrorism is going to leave us alone." 4 days after the attacks, the president and his national security team met at Camp David to discuss the response to 9/11. The briefing materials that Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz brought offered 3 targets in the war on terrorism: Al-Qaeda, Afghanistan's Taliban, and Iraq. But only Wolfowitz pressed the case that day for attacking Iraq. Wolfowitz's advocacy of attacking Iraq in response to 9/11 stemmed from the same views that later led him to underestimate the strength of the Iraqi insurgency, said a person who reviewed those Pentagon briefing materials. "In both cases, you have this know-it-all who won't believe the intelligence community and won't believe that non-state actors can do this much damage," he observed. Yet this person came away, as many critics do, finding himself oddly sympathetic to Wolfowitz. "There are 2 types of villains in Washington, hacks and fools," he concluded. "He isn't a hack. He's deeply misguided. He's impervious to evidence. And he's a serious, thoughtful guy." On September 20, Ahmed Chalabi went to the Pentagon to speak to the Defense Policy Board, an advisory group headed by Richard Perle. The first speaker at the meeting in Rumsfeld's conference room was Bernard Lewis, a historian of the Middle East whose pessimistic writings on Islam and terrorism had grown deeply influential within the Bush administration. The second speaker was Chalabi, an Iraqi exile leader. It was around this time, a senior military intelligence official recalled, that Perle's old subordinate Douglas Feith, who had become the Pentagon policy chief, put out the word to his aides to focus on Iraq. Powell usually was an astute judge of Washington politics, but in the fall of 2001, his judgment seemed off. He no longer had the upper hand, but he didn't seem to recognize it, at least in his public comments. "Iraq isn't going anywhere," he told Bill Keller of the New York Times in his trademark "everybody calm down" mode. "It's in a fairly weakened state. It's doing some things we don't like. We'll continue to contain it." But the tide already was shifting. By seeming to catch the intelligence community asleep, the 9/11 attacks had created a new opportunity for those arguing that the professional intelligence analysts were underestimating the threat presented by Iraq, and especially the likelihood of it possessing chemical or biological weapons, or its willingness to share them with anti-American terrorists. "If you missed the warning signs on 9/11, the argument went at the time, "what else are you missing now about Iraq?" The new doubts about intelligence, along with the caution of top military officers, combined to deeply frustrate Rumsfeld, recalled one covert operations specialist who worked for the defense secretary during this period. "What I saw from 9/11 forward was Don Rumsfeld's shock and disillusion with intelligence. He had been working for decades with an intelligence community that was focused on one question, the Soviet order of battle. But when the intelligence community had to move down the scale to low-intensity conflict, well..." His voice trailed off in the quiet disapproval of the disappointed professional. The first shock was on September 25, 2001, when Rumsfeld met with Charlie Holland, the Air Force general who then headed the U.S. Special Operations Command, which had been thrust into the limelight as one of the military commands most needed in response to al-Qaeda's attack. Holland laid out a bunch of targets, including a terrorist training camp in Northwest Africa, an arms shipment point on the Somali coast, and a camp in the Philippines. Rumsfeld's mouth was watering. "When do we go?" And Holland said, "Well, we can't because we lack actionable intelligence." Rumsfeld was perturbed by that phrase and seized on it. "What is actionable intelligence?" The defense secretary began asking, "Is there such a type of intelligence that is inactionable?" In the following weeks, Rumsfeld would take steps to substantially increase the role his office played in gathering and analyzing intelligence. Formal Pentagon consideration of how to attack Iraq began in November 2001, just after the fall of Kabul. From the outset, there was tension between the uniformed military and the Office of the Secretary of Defense, OSD, over two related issues: whether to attack Iraq, and if so, how many troops to use. Caught between the Army's caution and Rumsfeld's impatience was the Central Command, commanded by General Tommy Franks. Officials who served in that headquarters offer conflicting accounts of the role it played in the debate over the war plan, but there is general agreement that Franks became the fulcrum in the planning for the war. He could go either way. He was a career Army officer. But with the passage of time, he sided with the Rumsfeld view. Franks was a cunning man, but not a deep thinker. He ran an extremely unhappy headquarters. He tended to berate subordinates, frequently shouting and cursing at them. Morale was poor, and people were tired, having worked non-stop since 9/11. It wasn't just a matter of low spirits among staffers, one officer added. Frank's abusive style tended to distort the information that flowed upward to him. "I am convinced that much of the information that came out of Central Command is unreliable because he demands it instantly, so people pull it out of their hats. It's all swags. Scientific wild-ass guesses. Also, everything has to be good news stuff. You would find out you can't tell the truth." Many senior Army staff officers had worked at CENTCOM during the 1990s, and so were familiar with the series of war plans refined there during that decade. Others had rotated through Kuwait. As a group, They were comfortable with the work that Zinni had left behind, calling for a big invasion force of about 350,000 troops. But the world had changed, argued Air Force Major General Victor Renouart, who held the key job of Director of Operations for the Central Command. There was no longer a need for an invasion force of that size. "We had many more precision weapons," said the veteran pilot who had commanded a fighter squadron in the 1991 Gulf War and later led units in both the northern and southern no-fly zones. "We'd been flying over Iraq for 12 years and had substantially degraded their air defenses. We had good intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, and so good situational awareness of their ground forces." The conclusions of Desert Crossing, Zinni's post-Desert Fox study, were taken into consideration, but weren't a shaping factor, Renouart said. That plan envisioned attacking Iraq with three heavy armored divisions. It wasn't discarded, it just didn't fit the planning constraints we were given, he said. Among those constraints were to make the force smaller and faster than either the 1991 invasion force or Zinni's Desert Crossing force package. Ultimately, General Franks would employ a plan that used just one heavy division to spearhead the attack, backed by the helicopter-rich 101st Airborne, as well as lighter elements, part of the 82nd Airborne, and some Marine and British units. Zinni said he heard a rather different account of why his plan was discarded late in 2002, which essentially was that Rumsfeld and his aides simply vetoed his work. When the military guys, the Joint Staff, officers working on the staff of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, brought it up, the civilian leadership said, "No, its assumptions are too pessimistic," he said. Representative Ike Skelton, the senior Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, was alarmed as he listened to President Bush point to Iraq, Iran, and North Korea as threatening adversaries in his 2002 State of the Union address. "States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world," Bush warned. "We'll be deliberate, yet time is not on our side. I will not wait on events while dangers gather. I will not stand by as peril draws closer and closer. The United States of America will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us with the world's most destructive weapons." When the speech ended that January night, Skelton walked back across the hill to his congressional office and glumly told his staff, "That was a declaration of war." Skelton was a classic conservative Democrat from the heart of the country, representing a swath of 25 rural Missouri counties running from the edge of the Ozark Mountains north to the soybean fields along Interstate 70. The more he heard the Bush administration talk, the more he worried. The last of the Truman Democrats sensed he was about to be run over by the first of the 21st century Republicans. For George W. Bush was a bit of a revolutionary, having much more in common with the freewheeling 1960s than did Isaac Newton Skelton, a restrained son of the middle border. In the following months, Skelton would begin asking questions, including why did there appear to be no plans for post-war Iraq, and got few answers. For the next several years, his unhappy role would be that of a congressional Cassandra, his foresight accurate but disregarded. The next month, Wolfowitz trekked to Munich for the Verkunde meetings, an annual conference on security issues that brought together scores of top European and American defense officials and politicians. There, he confronted the contemptuous Germans. "Countries must make a choice," he told them, "about whether they would join the United States as it sought to preempt the threats it perceived in Iraq, Iran, and North Korea." He and Joseph Lieberman, the conservative Connecticut Democrat, whose mother-in-law had been held in the Dachau concentration camp just a few miles away, received moralistic responses from German and French politicians. Another member of the congressional delegation, Senator John McCain, the Arizona Republican, stood up at the end of the meeting to voice his support for Lieberman and Wolfowitz. The unified U.S. front seemed to make it clear the United States had Iraq in its sights. And it was going to be easy, some added. Rumsfeld's one-time assistant, Ken Edelman, sought to argue away worries about invading Iraq. I believe demolishing Hussein's military power and liberating Iraq would be a cakewalk, he wrote for the Washington Post's op-ed page in memorably provocative language. While Wolfowitz was in Munich, Central Command's rough draft of a plan for the invasion of Iraq began circulating quietly in parts of the Pentagon. The initial timetable was 1 October, just over half a year away, recalled one planning officer who was handed the document in an office of the Joint Staff one February afternoon. The plan led to a series of war games titled Prominent Hammer that sought, among other things, to judge the regional impact of a war in Iraq, as well as the strain that a war would impose on the U.S. military. Each game, a tabletop exercise in which likely second and third order consequences were gauged, took 3 or 4 days to play out, and each was followed by an in-depth staff analysis that kept parts of the Joint Staff working days stretching from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. In the first part of May, the conclusions of the first two games were sent across the Potomac to the White House to brief President Bush. Essentially, the briefing concluded that October would be too soon to invade Iraq. There were two major reasons offered. First, the planning officer recalled, "You got to set the conditions to lower the political risks of going to war by conducting an intense round of preparatory diplomacy. Also, there was a shortage of precision-guided weapons. We just dropped a bunch of PGMs in Afghanistan over the previous 6 months, and based on the combatant commander's statement, it would take several months to get back up to the level needed to go to war." In the wake of that briefing, the military had a sense that it had won some breathing room in the debate. The sense that an invasion of Iraq was imminent was undercut. The officers on the Joint Staff also thought they had given Franks the analytical results he needed to persuade Rumsfeld to